Jazz hit few saw coming in 1959, but it was recorded by the Dave Brubeck Quartet for their album Time Out. And then it went on to become the biggest selling jazz single of all time. There are countless versions of Take Five, but these are the originals. Paul Desmond, who composed the piece on alto sax, Dave Brubeck on piano, Eugene Wright on bass, and Joe Morello on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we continue. You know, we got to, the old saying is just, it's time to make the donuts. It's time to make the donuts here on Lead Stories. Ostensibly to commemorate deep historical ties and the continuing strength of the relationship between the United States and France, President Emmanuel Macron and First Lady Brigitte are the honored guests of a three-day state visit, hosted by President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump. The highlight of the visit, which began on Monday, is a series of bilateral talks and conferences scheduled today. And, of course, the obligatory fancy-schmancy white tie state dinner tonight at the White House. Macron's visit comes soon after France and Britain joined the United States in unsanctioned April 13 airstrikes on targets within Syria, alleged to be the production plants of chemical weapons the Bashar al-Assad regime is accused of using against its enemies in an ongoing civil war. We have the good fortune of being joined by Gilbert Mercier, co-founder and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and he's here to discuss the on-again, off-again budding bromance between Macron and Trump and the significance of Macron's state visit. Gilbert, great to have you with us today.
Oh, very nice to be on your show, Eutrice. And to be honest with you, I was sort of expecting more like a jazzy version of La Marseillaise as opposed to Take Five, but I won't hold that against you. It seems like everything is now as some sort of like French, tone in Washington and elsewhere in the U.S. Macron apparently, well, think he's like Lafayette, so here you go.
Yeah, things have become quite patriotic on both ends. What do you make initially of this visit?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the term bromance, and it's more like a strange relationship of like father and son, because Macron is the same age as President Trump's oldest son. So there's a great deal of age difference and a great deal of background. You know, Macron is an énarque. You know, he comes from like an elite background, and he sort of pretends to be a political outsider, and that's sort of what got him elected. But it's kind of disingenuous, considering he was the minister of the economy in the previous French government, in the Hollande government, that he eventually left to pursue personal political ambition. And he's sort of like, Macron is a little bit of a chameleon and also a backstabber. And as a matter of fact, former President Hollande described him as such in his upcoming book, you know, because Hollande kind of gave him his break. And it's kind of a story of E to Brutus, when Brutus is about to kill Julius Caesar. And it was sort of the same thing that Sarkozy, former President Sarkozy, did to Jacques Chirac, who made his political career. So he's not somebody, and that's kind of a point he shares with Trump. He's not necessarily somebody that is extremely loyal. He kind of, just like Trump, he sort of expects loyalty, but he's not necessarily going to be loyal to anyone. So it's a very strange, I mean, they couldn't be more different. I mean, one is sort of a globalist, multilateralist, and was actually officially endorsed by Barack Obama before the French election, which obviously that was not a problem, was not viewed as some sort of interference in the French election. I don't see why. And it seems like Trump and his, Steve Bannon, mainly his former campaign manager and advisor, was ostensibly in favor of the far-right French candidate Marine Le Pen. So it couldn't have not started on more rocky ground, but they seem to have, you know, maybe it's sort of like the notion that they view themselves as kind of, a bit like king, a bit like monarch. And maybe they share that, and maybe actually it's sort of a trend, this sort of like, and this is a very serious point. The Macron doesn't seem to have any issue with authoritarian rulers worldwide. He just hosted Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and he hosted as well Sisi, the dictator of Egypt, and he has a relationship, even so it's a little bit more rocky, with Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, who was becoming more and more dictatorial, as well as Russia's strongman Vladimir Putin and China's strongman Xi Jinping. So Macron doesn't really have problem with authoritarian persona. So it's something that is kind of a bit concerning, well, more than a bit concerning. It should be very concerning, as a matter of fact, for anybody that is attached to democracy and lessening the power of executive worldwide, because Macron tend to rule by executive order, And that's been the case in the U.S., ever since George W. Bush, really, ever since 2001.
What is interesting to me is this attempt, it looks like an attempt, to rearrange the standing political order. It used to be that the United States, if it is going to have allies, it would be principally Britain. Now Trump seems to be investing heavily in developing this relationship with France. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's very simple. Theresa May is not extremely popular, and she's dealing with Brexit, obviously, which is extremely rocky. And Trump's relationship with Angela Merkel is not good at all. It has never been good. Angela Merkel endorsed Hillary Clinton, and Angela Merkel power, because she had to strike a deal in a coalition, is sort of diminished, and Macron is using that to sort of grab the headlight. See, Macron is kind of an actor, and he's very clever at that. Grab the headlight, and as a matter of fact, he used a makeup artist, grab the headlight to become the point person of the U.S. in Europe. When the Trump administration want to deal with a European country, they call the Elysee, they call Macron. So he's trying to sort of cash in on this, but he should really be trading, Macron should be trading carefully, because he's kind of also the darling of the pseudo left, the liberal international left, or what's left of it. And by cozying up to Trump, he might alienate a lot of those people. And also, the reason why he's coming here. That's three reasons, besides all the symbolic hoopla and the fancy dinner and the speak in Congress, today. It's mainly three issues. The issue of Syria, which is disguised under the premise of fighting terrorism, but it's really to push the U.S., to push Trump, the Trump administration, at maintaining the troops they have in Syria. Very, very big issue for Macron, but it's not only a big issue for Macron, it's also a big issue for Israel. And I made that point yesterday on another radio show. It's a very big issue for Israel. Israel do not want the U.S. to leave Syria. And Macron, who I have to bring that to the attention of your listeners, used to work, his background is an investment banker, and he used to work for Rothschild Bank, who obviously has, historical tie with the Jewish state. I'm not suggesting anything here, but it's obviously, since the election of Macron, the policy of France in the region has been more and more in favor of the interest of Israel. Okay? So Macron has no issue really of having a lot of countries in Syria, such as Russia, Turkey, and the U.S. The problem is, of course, Iran, and that's because it's a problem for Israel, once again. And so there's going to be too many issues here. U.S. presence in Syria, military presence in Syria, tie with the wish of Trump to exit the nuclear deal, a lot more important, with Iran, and the deadline for that is May 12. So the clock is really ticking here. And the Ayatollah and the the president of Iran has said that if the U.S. get out of the deal, which involves six parties, which is, China, Russia, France, UK, U.S., and Germany, if the U.S. get out of the deal, then Iran, the deal will be off, and Iran will start again the program of uranium program, enrichment program. So this is the biggest issue here. The problem for Macron, who wants to stay in the deal, just like Germany and the UK, because there's a lot of business going on between Europe and Iran already since 2015, is that the new people around Trump, which is John Bolton mainly and Mike Pompeo, are adamant supporter of being extremely hostile vis-à-vis Iran, the neocon, especially John Bolton, of course, and it's kind of like the bomb Iran sort of scenario, if you wish. So it's going to be very, very difficult for Macron to sort of convince the U.S. to stay in that nuclear agreement, which is, of course, in the interest of the global international community. So this is the real issue here that is on the agenda of those meetings between Trump and Macron.
Okay, so that's one. What are the other two of the three top issues you identified?
Well, we have Syria, we have Iran, and we also have the trade agreement and trade war, which is actually apparently getting sorted out because the April 22nd, it looks like 28, the complete member of the EU, the European Union, will benefit from an exemption on tariff for export of steel and aluminum. So how long is the extension going to be? Nobody really knows at this juncture, but at least there's going to be an extension of the exemption on tariff. Now, I would think that Macron, who comes from finance, is going to also try to bring up the notion that the tariff and the trade war going on between the U.S. and China is really could create a situation of global recession, which most economists are saying, and maybe try to influence Trump on that. But I'm not sure if this is going to work in any way, shape, or form. And the thing is, by courting Trump in a way, the person that the French press has called the French Obama is really taking a chance, because if it comes empty-handed from the U.S., you know, then it's going to make him look bad. It's going to make him look like he really couldn't do anything, and he's basically just another little helper of U.S. imperialism, you know. I mean, he's basically trying to build his role on the international scene, but it's not necessarily going to work, you know. And I'll give you an example. France, you know, maybe I'm sure all the listeners will remember that. In 2003, when President Chirac, who was a lot more, who was a Gaullist and a lot more, independent in his mindset than Macron, refused to join the occupation of Iraq with the U.S. and the U.K. You know, French people were called, cheese-eating surrender monkey. You know, and It's not the case anymore because in 2013, and I think I came on your show to discuss this, France sent troops in Mali, and since then, they are supervising what is called the Sahel of G5, which include Chad, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania. And so it's under kind of French control, military control, and they're doing that in conjunction with the Pentagon and AFRICOM. So they've been a very diligent little helper of U.S. imperialism in Africa. So that's kind of a good score for them, you know. So that's probably also going to be in the topic of on the sideline, that is, because the new French foreign minister, his name is Yves Le Drian, is part of the trip. And at the time where the military intervention in Mali was set, he was the Minister of Defense in the Hollande administration. So it's sort of like France has become kind of like the U.S. in this extent, which is, oh, well, you Secretary of State one day and then, you know, Secretary of Defense another, just like here, you know, you head up the CIA one day and then you Secretary of State the other day.
But this is happening against a backdrop of very accelerated reaction on the part of the people. They are rejecting more and more this military adventurism, the expansion of their state in other regions, clearly for monetary reasons and for putting their hands on resources, and people are turning off. So certainly here in the United States, Trump, although they keep telling us how popular he is, his administration is fractured. It is regarded as an administration of kleptocrats, stealing as much as they can. It's riddled with corruption and a great disappointment to the Republican establishment. And it is getting people more and more agitated and more involved in opposing this kind of government, looking forward to a better way of doing things, a more democratic way of doing things, which doesn't seem to be happening anytime soon, but that doesn't mean that the resistance is building. In the way that you pointed out with France, you have a resistance that is building. It may not be getting the kind of traction that it needs right now to actually turn things around, but it's building. Factoring into this relationship now with the United States? And it's confirmed when the U.S. Basically took the lead in the April 13th bombing airstrikes in Syria.
Well, the bombing in Syria was kind of to test the Russian, in a way, to see what they were going to do, and the Iranian, and to also make Netanyahu and Israel happy. But it doesn't have any effectiveness, and as a matter of fact, it doesn't slow down at all the military progress of Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad, the reality of Syria, whatever they're saying, Bashar al-Assad, it's not a great option, but it's the only option. And everybody that has any kind of knowledge of the region understand that. He's part of the deal, and it's better to have some kind of orderly situation than a permanent civil war and basically a complete chaotic state, or a state that is not that is occupied by a bunch of different countries. But what you were saying, there's resistance to Trump in the U.S., but there's also a great deal of resistance to Macron in France. And 50 years ago, we had in France May 1968, and there's a great deal of social protests in France and demonstration and strike, and it's in every sector of the French life. You know, it's of course it affects the SNCF, the transport, public sector, student, and so on and so on. And what Macron wants to do is sort of like, in that sense, the French Maggie Thatcher. What he wants to do, he wants to privatize a public sector, and his notion of modernity and modernization of the economy is really to beat up on the working class and the middle class, to take away advantage that the French labor movement, it took them like 6 or 7 decades to establish. And unlike in the U.S., where the labor movement has been, you know, completely decapitated by Ronald Reagan, in France, it's still very, very much alive. As a matter of fact, the labor movement here is sort of like, it seems to be having a rebirth with the strike, the teacher strike in Oklahoma recently, and so on. But in France, you know, people are really getting fed up of this little arrogant little man that is acting sort of like more like a monarch. And what they want to do, they want to change the French constitution to reduce the Assemblée nationale. In France, you have the Assemblée nationale and the Senate. The Assemblée nationale is like Congress, okay? And he wants to reduce the Assemblée nationale by a third, the little king Emmanuel Macron, from 577 to 404. That means that people will have less representation. They will have less voice, and there will be more concentration of power in the end of the executive. So this is the trend, and it's kind of what's really uterus, what's really concerning. It's a global trend. This sort of concentration of not only wealth in the same hands, but also, of course, power, is a global trend. And this is, people should be extremely aware of it and very, very worried. And they need to do something about it. And they need to do something about it worldwide.
I want to return to the issue of Syria for a moment, because you just said something that just lit up my brain. I had said that one of the things that we have to be very thankful for in that situation is the extreme caution of Russia in this whole thing, that if Russia had reacted in a knee-jerk way, we would be in the middle of World War III right now. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was actually mentioning that, you know, I do some interview with Sputnik, which is a you know, Russian outlet, and so on. And I was mentioning that, and they show a lot of restraint, but in a way, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, Utris, because when the head of the Pentagon, who has the nickname of Mad Dog Matisse, is more reasonable than people at the State Department and the White House, you have a problem. You have a big problem, and there were a push. Bolton was pushing on the behalf of his neocon friend and of Israel, of course, to bomb Iranian sites and to bomb area where there could be Iranian and Russian. And that didn't happen. It was very, very limited. It was kind of symbolic, if you wish. So completely ineffective, and they made sure that they didn't hit any Russian asset. No, the Russians have been playing kind of an interesting game with Assad. They don't give him what I would call the good stuff. Assad still doesn't have the S-300, which are very efficient to shoot down airplanes. They might give him some, and he doesn't have S-400, which is even better to shoot down airplanes. So they are cautious. I think that Russia, I would say, they lost a little bit that battle in a way, but they have to be careful, because if they let those three allies, which I called the kind of wag the dog coalition, because they all had reason, domestic reason, to kind of, you know, distract their respective public opinion, Trump with Stormy Daniel, Macron with all the strike, Theresa May with, well, Salisbury affair and all that stuff, how should I put it? The thing is, with people like Bolton, who seems to be very, very close to Trump nowadays, anything could happen, such as, let's attack Iran. Let's get out of the deal and let's attack Iran. Now, what would Russia do if they do that? The alliance they have with Iran is structured in a strange way. What will they do? Will they do something if Iran is attacked by the, let's say, by Israel and the U.S.? I'm not sure. You know, so
visit, this state visit is over, what in particular are you going to be looking at in terms of consequences or developments as a result of this visit? What would you be monitoring?
Well, the big geopolitical issue is obviously the Iran nuclear deal that a lot of people with the Trump administration, especially the new people, especially Bolton and Pompeo, want to scrap. Now, how much of a resistance? Of course, Russia and China will be against scrapping that deal, but how much of a resistance France, Germany, and the UK will have? I already know that Macron wants to curtail missile development from Tehran, but that's not going to happen. Iran will not budge. You know, they will not budge. And I guarantee you, Utris, if the U.S. exit the agreement will be done. It will fall apart, because that's the only reason why the Iranian wants the agreement, is because the U.S. is in. And anything can happen. With somebody like Netanyahu, still Prime Minister of Israel, anything can happen. They will find a way, and of course, you know, it will happen again, where all those protagonists are sort of, you know, around each other in a very, very dangerous situation, which is Syria. I mean, Syria is really, could be the staging area. If things go wrong, if people lose their head, World War had been started for a lot less than that. And as a matter of fact, when that attack was unleashed, I already said, that's it. We are getting into World War III. This is the opening stage. So, again, you know, this notion that Bashar al-Assad have to go is ludicrous. It's just not a working situation. You know, and people in the region know that. They know that in Lebanon. A lot of people even know that in Israel. In Israel, for years, they said about the Assad dynasty, father and son, it's better to the devil you know than devil you don't know. And that's what they had. And so it's an issue of really of balance and stability. You know, it's not an issue of and all this notion of chemical attack and sort of pseudo humanitarian stuff. That's like the textbook that was used by Macron and Trump, textbook of humanitarian imperialists. You know, we'll bomb you because it's for justice, and we'll bomb you to save your life. You know.
Well, you've given us quite a backgrounder here today, Gilbert. Very thorough and very authoritative, and a lot to think about. Thank you so much for your time today. And we'll be talking again soon, because we have to see what the consequence was, what the results were of this state visit. And more things, I'm sure, would show up in this equation that we should be considering and talking about. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Utrecht. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, we take this little break and come back and talk a little bit with you right after this. Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrecht Lee. That we were just talking about the bromance between Emmanuel Macron of France and our very own esteemed President Donald Trump. There's a lot going on in the background, and as with all things, we'll find out what is happening, what is going on behind all this pomp and circumstance and state dinners and white tie events. So what was very interesting to me in what Gilbert said was about the role of Russia. It's not being discussed, I don't think, enough. The role of Russia in preventing a major global catastrophe simply by doing nothing, not taking the bait. Because in my view, that was part of the plan. Let them get involved militarily, excuse me, and we have a full-blown world war on our hands. Of course, we know these are maniacs. And they actually believe that even if World War III were to break out, they've got places they can go and relax until it's all over. Let the little people suffer and die. But we have to be very, very careful in, you see the roles that different countries are playing, and I'm very convinced about the fact that we have to thank Russia for exercising extraordinary restraint. Had Russia responded the way I think they were prodding and poking Russia to respond, there's no question. Global war. So it was very interesting to me that Gilbert, we haven't talked about any of this, but that he saw that too. Very interesting. Well, we have some time, and I am aware yesterday, and not everybody was able to get on air when I was talking about the Garner case and cases like it, and the difference between justice and settlements. The Garner case is certainly not over, but what I was pointing to more than anything else is the fact that we have to be so aware, constantly aware, that we're dealing with systems, not just instances or particular, you know, things. We're dealing with systems. It is why many people join the police department. Given the characters that they are, easily provoked, wanting, in fact, wanting to impose the law on citizens, they know that if they were to get in trouble, the system would come to their aid. And they've seen it happen over and over and over again. We have to really get this in our heads. Practically everything that we are interacting with or will be interacting with is a system of some sort or the other. Some of these systems are very well designed to resist any attempt to change or reform. And that's why they are systems. They're effective. They desire a particular outcome every time. They organize their systems to achieve exactly that. But we go up against these systems on the basis of our conviction that we are morally right. It has nothing to do with whether you're morally right. It has to do with the fact that even before you start, they can actually predict which way you're going to go. Systems. We are seeing before our eyes, for example, and everybody is endorsing it. Everybody has endorsed it for so many years. And that is that police departments are a law unto themselves, a court unto themselves. How could you have that? That's how they designed it. We control everything. When the average citizen does something really terrible, it goes to the court system. When a police officer does something really terrible, the police commissioner now becomes the law. The system within the police department now starts to operate extrajudicially. They are making opinions, binding opinions, that they have no power whatsoever to make. They judge cases, you know, who is guilty, who is not. They call them departmental hearings, but it's a court procedure. Just like in the military. When the average soldier goes crazy and does something, they don't bring that to the regular court. They say, no. We're taking care of this ourselves. This is a military court. But the action wasn't military. We're missing these points. There is no reason that police departments should be judge and jury of any crime committed by officers. The crime that we're talking here is the crime of murder. We got that covered in our regular law books. We could deal with it. But we don't deal with it because we're not allowed to deal with it. Why? Why can't regular citizens be drawn, form a jury pool, and the trial just take place? No. This they arrogate to themselves. And, you know, these are the questions that members of a local government should be raising. Why do we have to submit ourselves? There should be one law. A cop kills a person, that's called murder. It's not police murder, it's murder. Adjudicate that murder in a regular court of law, like any other citizen. If a citizen were to kill a cop, the citizen doesn't have the option of saying, well, I don't want to go to a regular court. I want to take this to a military court. You have no options. But we constantly forget that we are dealing with deeply entrenched systems that are designed first and foremost to counter whatever it is people on the outside are trying to do to reform it. They don't want reforms. And so they operate on the premise that we're stupid, incapable, inexperienced. We don't have the specialized knowledge. Now, what is the specialized knowledge? We saw a cop, aided and abetted by several other cops, apply the chokehold, which was banned even by the police department itself. It resulted in the death of a citizen. That's called murder. In fact, even worse than regular murder, this is aggravated murder. Okay. And yet, we are told that the issue is one cop. No, the issue is all the cops who were there, who did nothing to prevent it from happening, who knew what was going on. They knew that that man was dying. They knew that that was the intention of Daniel Pantaleo. He set out. And he was so short, he couldn't even get up to the point. So they helped him. They helped him score one for the pack. Nobody pays the price. Now, in the regular world, we know this all the time. One person may fire the gun. But if he is in a group of five people, all of them are responsible and are deemed to be contributing to that murder. These are the systems that are at work. I keep calling for open hearings by the city council, which is the government of the city of New York. They have the power and authority to begin to dismantle these internal systems. Somebody has to explain how a cop goes from being a suspect. He's not convicted. How come? Because he does not go through the regular court system. Why? And more than that, he's able to gain half as much as his regular salary when he returns, in addition to his regular salary. Nobody else, there's no price to pay for killing a person. intentionally killing a person. That means his supervisor, the police commissioner, need to be fired because they clearly have not driven home the point that that chokehold is illegal. The chokehold is a death system. They know it. Will we find anybody in the city council willing to openly have hearings on this matter? To remove cases from within the police department. They clearly have a very bad track record of covering up. These are crimes of the most grievous nature. And their lives go on because in their system, you know, which is racist, it allows them to do things that they used to do in the old New York. You could kill anybody and get away with it. And still walk around with a badge on your chest. And still get retirement. And the full benefits of a police officer who really is doing his job. You're not doing the job, you're a thug. And if thugs are what the police department wants, look, you could go to any jail, any prison, and then get your police officers from there. You might as well do that. And then we have all these people making all these excuses for not doing their jobs because they're terrified to take these things on. Oh, well, we don't know whether it was a chokehold. Really? I could tell you it was a chokehold. The coroner could tell you this was a chokehold. The average citizen could tell you it was a chokehold. But you can't figure out that this was a chokehold. You just can't do that. Certainly you don't know what a chokehold is. And then we build in all these complications about how we are going to adjudicate a case and deliver justice. This is what is at the bottom line, justice. Have no interest in justice. They have an interest in maintaining a system. It's race-based and it's power-based. And in the end, it's money-based as well. And this is an issue that needs to be brought forward because it is universal. The power of police unchecked in our society. And the commonality among all these incidents is that very often the police doing these things are white, the victims are black and Latino. And it may not constitute a crisis as far as the power structure is concerned, but we don't have to worry about what the power structure is concerned with. It concerns us. And it is important that we find some mechanism to bring this to light. This government has aided and abetted the murders of citizens because it is too cowardly to take on people with the badge. who are as lawless as any of the people they condemn out in the street. You know, they're always some kind of excuse and psychological conditioning so that the public should feel no sorrow, no concern, should feel nothing except vanquished by the awesome power of the state. They know what they're doing. The thing is, we have to insist that they should know that we know what they're doing. It is wrong. And simply because you could say, well, we settled the case, we explained that. These people are put between a rock and a hard place, and they convince themselves that, well, something is better than nothing. But if they had a choice, a genuine choice, between fighting for the right cause and taking money from a system, they would fight for a right cause. And as I've explained, there's nothing wrong with looking for damages because it's provided by the law. When a person is wronged, the other party has a duty to make them whole. So it's not as a nasty and low down of saying, well, oh, they're in it for the money. Not at all. But we have to constantly remember we're dealing with systems that intended to be around long after we're all dead and gone. Thank you for joining me today and for allowing me to share some more with you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.